however, later seek an opportunity to exact revenge. In November, Roosevelt and Wallace handily defeated Wendell Willkie and Charles McNary, winning 55% of the vote. Before the vote, Roosevelt promised that he would keep the United States out of the war. He told an overflow crowd in Boston Garden, "I have said this before, but I shall say it again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." But the United States was indeed inching closer to the conflict, and was already supplying Great Britain with much of its military needs, including artillery, tanks, machine guns, rifles, and thousands of planes. In early January 1941, Roosevelt upped the ante further by proposing lend-lease aid to Great Britain in a bill patriotically numbered H.R. 1776. This would give him enormous discretion in providing assistance, short of war, to the increasingly desperate British, without worrying about the silly, foolish dollar sign. The response to Roosevelt's message showed the challenge he faced in convincing the country that war was in the United States' best interest. At a press conference the next day, Eleanor Roosevelt said she was astonished and saddened by the cold Republican response to the president's message. Republican critics were indeed more incensed than ever. Thomas Dewey, who would later run for president, warned that the bill would bring an end to free government in the United States and would abolish the Congress for all practical purposes. Alf Landon called it the first step toward dictatorship by Mr. Roosevelt. Landon saw the handwriting on the wall. "Step by step, he is working us into war," he charged. Gerald Nye contended that if Lend-Lease passed, war is almost inevitable. Critics feared that loans and other ties to Great Britain would again draw the United States into war as they had in 1917. A heated debate erupted in Congress. Democratic Senator Burton Wheeler of Montana dismissed the thought that Hitler would ever declare war on the United States and charged that the Lend-Lease Give program was the New Deal's AAA foreign policy, plow under every fourth American boy. Roosevelt shot back, saying that Wheeler's comment was the most untruthful, the most dastardly, unpatriotic, the rottenest thing that has been said in public in my generation. Roosevelt's defenders agreed that aiding Great Britain was the United States' best chance to avoid being drawn into the war. Senator Joshua Lee of Oklahoma came to the president's defense. "Hitler is a madman standing at the switch of the most powerful and destructive machine that the human brain ever devised. The charred ruins of an entire continent stand as grim proof that he does not hesitate to throw that switch. America has only one chance to escape total war, and that chance is England. England is the only barrier between America and a baptism of blood." Lend-Lease passed Congress in early March, with an amendment banning the U.S. Navy from providing protection for the convoys carrying the goods. Congress appropriated the first $7 billion out of what would eventually total $50 billion to fund the shipments. Senator Arthur Vandenberg vented, "We have torn up 150 years of traditional American foreign policy. We have tossed Washington's farewell address in the discard. We have thrown ourselves squarely into the power politics and power wars of Europe, Asia, and Africa. We have taken the first step upon a course from which we can never hereafter retreat." Prime Minister Churchill thanked the Americans profusely. He telegrammed the president, "Our blessings from the whole of the British Empire go out to you." The British soon realized, however, that there were limits to Roosevelt's largesse and his support for the perpetuation of Churchill's empire. Roosevelt included provisions in the Lend-Lease Act that would allow the United States to penetrate the British Empire's closed trading sphere and prevent its re-establishment after the war. The British were less than thrilled at the prospect or at the forced sale of British assets. Churchill complained, "We are not only to be skinned, but flayed to the bone." But he understood that, much as Roosevelt's critics feared, the United States was on the path to war. I would like to get them hooked a little firmer, he confessed, but they are pretty on now. The American people, it turned out, were increasingly willing to hook themselves. Their sympathies lay entirely with the Allies. A Gallup poll released in October 1939 found that 84% wanted Great Britain and France to win the war. Only 2% were rooting for Germany. Still, at that point, 95% wanted the United States to stay out of the war. Ironically, it was Hitler who helped end Great Britain's isolation, as history took another dramatic turn on June 22, 1941. Breaking its 1939 treaty with the USSR, Germany launched Operation Barbarossa, a full-scale invasion of the Soviet Union. Stalin, who had earlier purged much of his general staff, ignored repeated warnings that an attack was imminent. His forces were caught completely off guard as 3.2 million German troops attacked along a 2,000-mile front. Germany quickly pushed deep into the Soviet Union. The Luftwaffe destroyed Soviet air units, and the Wehrmacht encircled Soviet forces, inflicting terrible losses. The Nazis advanced toward Leningrad, Smolensk, and Kiev. The crippling blow dealt to the Red Army by the Nazi Blitzkrieg sparked fears in London and Washington that Stalin would conclude a separate peace with Hitler, as Lenin had done with Germany in 1918. The Soviet Union certainly felt little allegiance toward Great Britain, France, and the United States, each of which had, in its own way, tried to undermine the Russian Revolution. Beginning in 1925 with the publication of Mein Kampf, Hitler had repeatedly expressed his enmity toward the Soviet Union. As his expansive intentions became clear in the mid-1930s, Stalin's appeals to England and France for a military alliance against Germany proved fruitless. When the Soviets aided the Republican forces in Spain, who were locked in bitter combat with the German and Italian-backed army of General Francisco Franco, British conservatives, including Winston Churchill, sympathized with Franco's fascist rebels. The Soviets also deplored the Allies' craven performance at Munich, which effectively gave the Germans free rein to destroy the Soviet Union. Few people believed that the Soviets could withstand the Nazi onslaught. The U.S. Army calculated that they could hold on for no more than 3 months, and might even fold in 4 weeks. Roosevelt and Churchill desperately sought to keep the Soviets in the war, knowing that Great Britain's survival might depend on it. Swallowing his long-standing hatred of communism, Churchill pledged support for the Soviet Union and urged his allies to do the same. He promised to destroy Hitler and every vestige of the Nazi regime. Acting Secretary of State, Sumner Wells, issued a statement on behalf of the President, indicating that material assistance to the Soviet Union might be forthcoming, but left the question of lend-lease up in the air for the time being. Some tried to nip that idea in the bud. Missouri Senator Harry Truman fanned the flames of mistrust toward the Soviet Union, recommending, "If we see that Germany is winning, we ought to help Russia, and if Russia is winning, we ought to help Germany. And that way let them kill as many as possible." Ignoring Truman's advice, Roosevelt asked the Soviet ambassador to compile a list of items the United States might provide. In July, Roosevelt sent Harry Hopkins to Moscow to take the Soviets' pulse and assess their staying power. He instructed Stalin to treat Hopkins with the same identical confidence you would feel if you were talking to me. Stalin acknowledged the German military superiority, but said that the Soviets would take advantage of the winter lull to be ready to fight by spring. "Give us anti-aircraft guns and the aluminum for planes, and we can fight on for 3 or 4 years." Hopkins believed him. By August, Roosevelt ordered delivery of the first 100 fighter planes. More supplies were on the way. U.S. military leaders, intent upon building up U.S. defenses, impeded Roosevelt's efforts. The British also objected to diversion of their supplies. Seeing the bigger picture, Roosevelt ordered Secretary of War Henry Stimson and other cabinet members to speed delivery to the Soviet Union. His announcement that W. Averill Harriman would be leading a U.S. delegation to Moscow to confer on providing more military aid, drew an outraged response from Robert McCormick's right-wing Chicago Tribune. A national emergency does not require that an American mission go to the bloody Kremlin to consider the needs of the greatest barbarian of modern times. We are not required by our national interests or our national dangers to join hands with a system of government which professes undying contempt for everything we regard as necessary in our way of living, and plans unremitting and unrelenting warfare against such people as constitute the American nation. Given the depth of anti-Soviet sentiment in the United States, Roosevelt felt he had to move gingerly in providing tangible assistance to the Soviet government. A Gallup poll found that only 35% of respondents favored aiding the Soviets on the same basis as that offered to Great Britain 3 months earlier. On November 7, 1941, the 24th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, Roosevelt announced that the United States would extend lend-lease aid to the Soviet Union. The president offered $1 billion interest-free credit to be repaid, starting 5 years after the end of the war. But when promised U.S. aid failed to arrive, Soviet elation turned bitter. The New York Times reported that U.S. shipments in October and November had fallen far, far short of the specified tonnage of materials of war the United States had committed. In fact, the United States had delivered less than half of what it had offered. Arthur Kroc attributed this to special circumstances, but failed to mention deliberate foot-dragging by some who disapproved the entire enterprise. The failure to deliver the promised equipment dealt a crushing blow to Soviet prospects, with Moscow and Leningrad under siege, Ukraine occupied, and the Red Army suffering debilitating losses, and did little to convince the Soviets of U.S. goodwill. Roosevelt wanted the United States in the war, and like Wilson before him, maneuvered quietly to make that happen. He believed that Hitler was intent on world domination and must be stopped. In early 1941, U.S. and British military officers met to devise a strategy for first defeating Germany and then engaging Japan that they would implement upon the U.S. entry into the war. In the meantime, Germany's U-boat campaign was undermining U.S. efforts to supply Great Britain, sinking an inordinate number of British ships. In April, Roosevelt began allowing U.S. ships to provide vital intelligence to the British about the presence of enemy ships and planes, and soon authorized transporting supplies to British soldiers in North Africa, precipitating direct confrontations with German U-boats. After one incident, a German communique charged Roosevelt with endeavoring with all the means at his disposal to provoke incidents for the purpose of baiting the American people into the war. In September, after one of these allegedly unprovoked attacks, Roosevelt announced a shoot-on-sight policy toward German and Italian ships in U.S. waters. In August 1941, Roosevelt met secretly with Churchill in Newfoundland. The two leaders drew up the Atlantic Charter, which, much like Wilson's 14 points, articulated a democratic and progressive set of war aims. It would remain to be seen if the United States could deliver better this time around. The charter avowed territorial aggrandizement and territorial changes without the consent of the governed. It proclaimed self-government, equal access to trade and resources for victors and vanquished alike, a peace allowing freedom from fear and want, freedom of the seas, disarmament, and a permanent system of general security. Fearing that Roosevelt's proposed wording threatened Great Britain's colonial sphere, Churchill added a clause stipulating that equal access to international wealth would be guaranteed only with due respect for existing obligations. Roosevelt turned down Churchill's request to have the United States join the war immediately. But Churchill's account of the talks captures Roosevelt's true intentions. Roosevelt, he told his cabinet, said he would wage war but not declare it, and that he would become more and more provocative. If the Germans did not like it, they could attack American forces. Everything was to be done to force an incident that could lead to war. Though some people might excuse Roosevelt's deceptive behavior in the lead-up to the war as a necessary manipulation of public opinion in a righteous cause, future presidents would also take it upon themselves to play fast and loose with the truth in manipulating the nation into wars, as Woodrow Wilson had done a quarter century earlier. Such a policy, in the hands of less scrupulous and less far-sighted presidents, much like Roosevelt's wartime abuse of civil liberties, would pose a grave threat to the nation and its republican system of governance. The president ultimately got his wish, but it was not triggered by an incident in Europe, as most were anticipating. On December 7, 1941, the day President Roosevelt said would live in infamy, the Japanese Navy attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, leaving almost 2,500 dead and sinking or disabling much of the U.S. fleet. The Americans were caught literally sleeping on a Sunday morning. They knew an attack from Japan was coming, but they didn't anticipate that it would be in Hawaii. It was an intelligence failure on a colossal scale. Given the abundance of warning signs and the degree of ineptitude involved, much as with the attacks on September 11, 2001, many believed then and now that Roosevelt must have abetted the attack in order to draw the United States into the war. The evidence, however, does not support that charge. The next day, Great Britain and the United States declared war on Japan. 3 days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. The bloodletting and chaos would soon engulf the globe. The United States had stood in the way of Japan's plans for conquest. Japanese leaders had been eyeing the rich French and Dutch colonies that the German subjugation of continental Europe had made ripe for the plucking. Though some army officers argued that Japan should join Germany and first knock out its old Russian antagonist to the north, other strategists prevailed. As a result, Japan invaded French Indochina to the south in July 1941, seeking the resources and bases needed to fortify its position in the region. The United States responded by completely embargoing petroleum exports to Japan. Its supplies dwindling, Japan's leaders decided to secure oil from the Dutch East Indies, but they feared that the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor could interfere with their efforts. With the United States and its allies focused on the European theater, the Japanese conquest proceeded largely unimpeded. Thailand, Malaya, Java, Borneo, the Philippines, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Burma, Singapore. Citizens of those countries often greeted the Japanese as liberators from European colonial oppressors. President Roosevelt said privately, "Don't think for a minute that Americans would be dying in the Pacific if it hadn't been for the short-sighted greed of the French and the British and the Dutch." Subjugated peoples' embrace of the Japanese liberators would prove short-lived. Japan failed to deliver the knockout blow at Pearl Harbor that it desperately sought. The Allies began a counteroffensive led by General Douglas MacArthur and Admiral Chester Nimitz. In June 1942, U.S. forces defeated the Japanese Navy at Midway and initiated their island-hopping strategy. In some ways, this war would change the world even more dramatically than the First World War. Anticipating the creation of a new world order, influential Americans began offering their visions of what might emerge and the role the United States could play to make that happen. One of the most compelling visions was outlined in early 1941 by publishing magnate Henry Luce in an editorial in Life magazine. Luce, who also published Time and Fortune, had apparently recovered from his earlier infatuation with Mussolini, and now anointed the 20th century the American century. He wrote, "We must accept wholeheartedly our duty and our opportunity as the most powerful and vital nation in the world, and in consequence to exert upon the world the full impact of our influence, for such purposes as we see fit and by such means as we see fit." Some applauded this statement as an affirmation of democratic values within an evolving international capitalist market. Former New Deal administrator Raymond Moley knew better and urged Americans to disavow this temptation to drift into empire. Vice President Henry Wallace deplored all empires, whether British, French, German, or American. In May 1942, Wallace repudiated Luce's nationalistic and arguably imperial vision and proposed a progressive internationalist alternative. Some have spoken of the American century. I say, the century which will come of this war can and must be the century of the common man. No nation will have the God-given right to exploit other nations. There must be neither military nor economic imperialism. International cartels that serve American greed and the German will to power must go. The march of freedom of the past 150 years has been a great revolution of the people. There were the American Revolution of 1775, the French Revolution of 1792, the Latin American revolutions of the Bolivian era, the German Revolution of 1848, and the Russian Revolution of 1917. Each spoke for the common man. Some went to excess. But people groped their way to the light. Modern science, which is a byproduct and an essential part of the people's revolution, has made it possible to see that all of the people of the world get enough to eat. We shall not rest until all the victims under the Nazi yoke are freed. The people's revolution is on the march. When the bloodiest war in human history finally drew to a close 3 years later, Americans would choose between these diametrically opposed visions, Luce's American century versus Wallace's century of the common man. The United States' entry into the war following the attack at Pearl Harbor only complicated the fight over scarce resources. Meeting the United States' own defense requirements made it that much more difficult for it to fulfill its commitments to the Soviet Union. In late December, Averell Harriman estimated that the United States had shipped only a quarter of the tonnage of supplies promised, and much of what had been sent was defective. In late February, Lend-Lease Administrator Edward Stettinius wrote to Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy, "As you are aware, the relations between this government and the Soviet government have been constantly disturbed by the failure of this government to meet its commitments." Roosevelt understood the terrible position the U.S. failure to deliver was putting the Soviet Union in, and what it might mean for future relations. In March, he admitted his apprehensions about a Russian collapse because of U.S. negligence. "I do not want to be in the same position as the English, who promised the Russians two divisions. They failed. They promised them help in the Caucasus. They failed. Every promise the English have made to the Russians, they have fallen down on." In May 1942, Roosevelt told General MacArthur, "I find it difficult to get away from the simple fact that the Russian armies are killing more Axis personnel and destroying more Axis material than all the other 25 United Nations put together. Therefore, it has seemed wholly logical to support the great Russian effort in 1942 by seeking to get all munitions to them that we possibly can." Roosevelt knew that delays in delivering the promised military equipment had cost him an opportunity to win Stalin's trust, but other opportunities would present themselves. Stalin made two additional requests of his allies. Perhaps delivering on these would allow the United States to regain the initiative. Stalin sought territorial concessions. He wanted to retain the gains the Red Army had seized after his 1939 pact with Hitler, the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, eastern Poland, and parts of Romania and Finland. The British were inclined to go along, but felt caught in a difficult bind, pulled between U.S. and Soviet interests, needing Soviet help to survive the war and U.S. assistance to preserve their empire after the war. Churchill pressed Roosevelt to allow him to offer Stalin the territorial concessions he desired. He warned Roosevelt that a break with the Soviets would bring down his government, which would be replaced by a communist pro-Moscow government. The Americans refused to budge and instructed British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden to make no post-war commitments during his trip to Moscow in late December 1941. Stalin responded angrily to Eden's rebuff of his demands, leading Churchill to appeal to Roosevelt again. "The Atlantic Charter," he insisted, "ought not to be construed so as to deny to Russia the frontiers which she occupied when Germany attacked." Having failed to receive either the promised aid or territorial gains, Stalin pressed even harder for his third and most significant demand: rapid establishment of a second front in Europe to alleviate pressure on his beleaguered military. He urged the British to invade northern France. In September 1941, he pressed them to send 25 or 30 divisions to the Soviet Union. Questioning the sincerity of Great Britain's commitment, he said, "By her passive attitude, Britain is helping the Nazis. Do the British understand this? I think they do. What is it then they want? It seems they want us to be weakened." The lack of outside support may have left the Soviets weak, but they refused to collapse. Despite suffering catastrophic losses in the early months of the war, the Red Army defeated Germany in the Battle of Moscow in the fall and winter of 1941 to 1942. For the first time, the mighty German war machine had been stopped. To Roosevelt, territorial concessions smacked of the secret treaties that had tied Wilson's hands during the First World War. They contradicted the spirit of the Atlantic Charter. He preferred to launch an invasion of Western Europe at the earliest possible date. In early 1942, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, working for Army Chief of Staff General George C. Marshall, drew up plans for an invasion of Europe by spring 1943 at the latest, and by September 1942, if necessary to stave off Soviet defeat, which was still a possibility. As Eisenhower stated emphatically in July 1942, "We should not forget that the prize we seek is to keep 8 million Russians in the war." Eisenhower, Marshall, and Stimson all saw this as the only way to defeat Germany. Roosevelt agreed. He sent Harry Hopkins and General Marshall to convince Churchill to go along. He wrote to Churchill, "Your people and mine demand the establishment of a front to draw off pressure on the Russians, and those people are wise enough to see that the Russians are killing more Germans and destroying more equipment than you and I put together." Churchill understood how important this plan was to Roosevelt and his advisers. He cabled the president, "I am in entire agreement in principle with all you propose, as so are the chiefs of staff." Convinced that he had British support, Roosevelt asked Stalin to send Minister of Foreign Affairs, Vyacheslav Molotov, and a trusted general to Washington to discuss a proposal that would ease the pressure on the Western Front. On the way, Molotov stopped in London, where Churchill was anything but reassuring about the Second Front. Molotov arrived in the U.S. Capitol in late May 1942. He asked Roosevelt bluntly if the United States indeed planned to open up another front that coming summer. Roosevelt turned to Marshall, who assured him that the United States was prepared to do so. The two sides issued a joint public communique stating that, "In the course of the conversations, full understanding was reached with regard to the urgent tasks of creating a second front in Europe in 1942. Roosevelt also laid out a breathtaking vision for post-war collaboration. The victors, he explained, would keep their armaments and form an international police force. The four policemen, the United States, United Kingdom, USSR, and China, would disarm the Germans and their allies and preserve peace by force." Stalin was delighted by the plans, but far less pleased by Roosevelt's insistence that preparing the Second Front would necessitate cutting aid to the Soviet Union to 60% of what he had originally promised. Still, the Second Front was the Soviet Union's main priority, and Roosevelt planned to deliver. He notified Churchill, "I have a very strong feeling that the Russian position is precarious and may grow steadily worse during the coming weeks. Therefore, I am more than ever anxious that Bolero, the first phase of the operation, proceed to definite action beginning in 1942. The Soviet people were elated by the news. The New York Herald Tribune reported that they had been gathering around their radios every morning, hoping for news that the invasion had begun, only to have their hearts sink when they discovered it hadn't. Pulitzer Prize-winning Moscow correspondent Leland Stowe reported that if the front were postponed, the disillusionment of the great mass of Russian people would be almost immeasurable. The present steadily mounting and invaluable cooperation between the Soviet, British, and American governments and leaders would suffer such a setback as to constitute diplomatically, materially, and psychologically a major disaster for the Allied cause. The U.S. ambassador in Moscow similarly warned that postponement would make the Russian people doubt U.S. sincerity and do inestimable harm. Despite reaching a similar agreement with Molotov regarding the Second Front, the British had no intention of going along with the plans. Arguing that they lacked sufficient troops due to the crisis in the Middle East, 33,000 British troops had just humiliatingly surrendered to an enemy force half that size at Tobruk in Libya, and that they could not muster enough ships to transport invading forces across the English Channel, Churchill convinced Roosevelt to postpone the promised invasion, and instead mount an invasion of Vichy-occupied North Africa, which was the key to the oil-rich Middle East, where the British had important colonial interests that were being threatened by Hitler's forces. The Soviet leaders were furious about this reversal, which many considered part of a conscious strategy of allowing the Soviet Union to be bled dry fighting the Nazis, while its capitalist allies secured their global interests, and then marched in to set the peace terms at the end of the war. To make matters worse from the Soviet standpoint, during his stop in London, Molotov, in gratitude for the pledged Second Front, had not pressed his territorial demands. The Soviets now felt as if all three of their major demands had been denied. Relations among the Soviets, Americans, and British hit rock bottom in the fall of 1942, with the Nazi onslaught against Stalingrad. Symptomatic of the Soviets' acute mistrust of their Western allies was the fact that Molotov, when traveling in the West, always slept with a gun under his pillow. Furious with this British-imposed change of plans, Marshall lobbied unsuccessfully against the invasion of North Africa, which he dismissed as periphery pecking. The United States had delayed major operations in the Pacific in order to expedite victory in Europe. Now those plans had been abandoned in an apparent attempt to secure British imperial interests in the Middle East, South Asia, and Southern Europe. Marshall was so angry that he proposed reversing course and taking on the Japanese before confronting the Germans. Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Ernest King enthusiastically agreed. "The British would never invade Europe," he sneered, "except behind a Scotch bagpipe band." Marshall's disgust reverberated down the ranks. General Albert Wiedemeyer told Marshall that the British war plans had been designed to maintain the integrity of the British Empire. General Henry Hap Arnold, chief commander of the Army Air Forces, suggested to Marshall that perhaps the Americans should start dealing with the British the same way that the Germans treated the Italians. U.S. military leaders believed that the British, unlike the Soviets, were afraid to take on the Germans. As Secretary of War Stimson mused the next year, "The shadows of Passchendaele and Dunkirk still hang too heavily over the imagination of Churchill's government." Eisenhower, Stimson, Hopkins, and the military chiefs continued to push forcefully for a second front, but to no avail. In June 1942, the U.S. chiefs of staff reluctantly agreed to the Torch Campaign in North Africa, under Eisenhower's command. Although a case could indeed have been made that the Allies lacked the landing craft, air cover, and sufficient number of troops to pull off a second front in late 1942 or early 1943, such arguments were not convincing to the Soviets, or at the time, to U.S. military leaders. Eisenhower predicted that the day they decided to proceed with Torch would go down as the blackest day in history. But whether deterred by fear or not, the British never had any intention of directly engaging the powerful Wehrmacht, and had instead designed a strategy based on sea power and attacking Hitler's vulnerable southern flank, which was protected by weaker Italian forces. Great Britain decided to secure North Africa, the Mediterranean, and the Middle East, in order to hold on to Persian and Iraqi oil reserves, and maintain its access to India and the rest of the empire through the Suez Canal and Gibraltar. The discovery of enormous oil reserves shortly before the war in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar further drove home the importance of this region, where much of the early fighting between British, German, and Italian forces had occurred. Great Britain was so intent upon keeping the Axis powers out of the Middle East that it diverted troops and tanks there, even though they were desperately needed to defend the homeland against an imminent German attack. During these months, the American people's attitude toward the Soviet Union was undergoing a profound shift. For many Americans, the Nazi-Soviet pact had confirmed their worst suspicions about Soviet communism, causing an outpouring of anti-Soviet feeling between 1939 and 1941. But much of that disappeared as the Soviets' courageous resistance against the Nazis captured Americans' imagination and sympathy. The resulting outpouring of goodwill toward the Soviet Union would lay the basis, many hoped, for friendship and collaboration in the war's aftermath as well. Within days of the attack on Pearl Harbor, Soviet diplomat Maxim Litvinov visited the State Department. Secretary of State Cordell Hull used the occasion to applaud the Soviet Union's heroic struggle against the Nazis. Before long, the notion of Soviet heroism was ubiquitous. In April 1942, New York Times correspondent Ralph Parker commended how rapidly and how completely the Russian people had adapted themselves to war conditions. He applauded their willingness to sacrifice and their extraordinary work ethic. The whole people are caught up with an enthusiastic passion to be doing something constructive for the common task. He proclaimed, "It would need a Tolstoy to describe the heroic endurance of the men and women who have made these things possible." In June 1942, the month marking the first anniversary of Soviet resistance to the German invaders, Orville Prescott, the New York Times principal daily book reviewer, was already crediting the Red Army with winning the war and saving humanity. The vast armaments, the fighting skill and magnificent courage of the Red Army may prove to have been the decisive factors in the salvation of the human race from Nazi slavery, Prescott gushed. Our debt of gratitude to the millions of Russian soldiers who have fought and died in this war, and who will continue to do so, is beyond estimation or expression. General MacArthur credited the Red Army with one of the greatest military feats in history. Hollywood pitched in too. Though it had once scrupulously avoided making films about the Soviet Union, in July 1942, at least 9 movies about the Soviet Union were in production or under consideration by such major studios as MGM, Columbia, United Artists, 20th Century Fox, and Paramount. 5 significant motion pictures eventually appeared: Mission to Moscow, North Star, Song of Russia, 3 Russian Girls, and Days of Glory. A consensus was building that without the Second Front, the war could not be won. After acknowledging that the Russians have done most of the fighting and most of the dying, the Atlanta Constitution contended that though a Second Front would bring tragedy to many American homes, it must be done if the war is to be won. Leland Stowe reminded readers that the Soviet Union could not hold out alone forever. In 13 months, the Russians have suffered more than 4,500,000 in killed, wounded, and prisoners, probably 6 or 7 times Great Britain's losses in nearly 3 years of war, 20 times the total American casualties in the First World War. He stressed that Soviet Russia is the one great power which is indispensable as an ally of the United States if we are going to win the war. If Russia's fighting millions were suddenly removed from the scene, they alone would be irreplaceable. With the steady barrage of pro-Soviet and pro-Second Front coverage, the American public rallied to the cause. In July 1942, Gallup reported that 48% of Americans wanted the United States and Great Britain to attack immediately, while only 34% wanted to wait until the Allies were stronger. Americans pasted bumper stickers reading, second front now on their cars. Readers flooded newspapers with letters calling for an immediate attack on Hitler's forces in Europe. Among the many published by the Washington Post, one, inspired by the spectacle of a courageous ally who alone has withstood and forced back the Nazi hordes, demanded that Great Britain and the United States divide the forces of Hitler by opening a Western Front and together with our Russian ally crush this menace to world freedom and civilization. Support was building in all directions. 38 leaders of the CIO told Roosevelt that only immediate land invasion of Western Europe will guarantee winning the war. 5 days later, the organization hosted a pro-Second Front rally in New York City's Madison Square Park. Several AFL affiliates lent their support. Elected officials jumped on the bandwagon, including Senators James Meade of New York and Claude Pepper of Florida. New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia and New York State Representative Vito Marcantonio. In September, author Dashiell Hammett released the names of 500 writers who, under the banner of the League of American Writers, declared themselves enthusiastically behind President Roosevelt for the immediate opening of a second front now. 25,000 people rallied in New York's Union Square as Representative Marcantonio and Communist Party head Earl Browder addressed the crowd. The 1940 Republican Party presidential candidate, Wendell Willkie, added his endorsement, following a meeting in Moscow with Stalin. But despite the public demand for a second front in Europe, U.S. and British troops headed off to North Africa. Left to its own devices, the resurgent Red Army reversed the course of the war, vanquishing the Nazis at Stalingrad. More than 1 million soldiers were engaged on each side. The Germans, under General Friedrich Paulus, were pushing to take control of the Soviet Union's rich oil fields in the Caucasus. The Soviets, under Marshal Georgi Zhukov, were determined to stop them at all costs. The 6-month battle was fierce, the human toll horrific. Casualties exceeded 750,000 on each side, and civilian deaths totaled over 40,000. After that colossal defeat, the German army began a full-scale retreat from the Eastern Front. Hitler, stunned by the surrender of 23 generals and the Sixth Army's 91,000 troops, lamented, "The God of War has gone over to the other side." By the time Roosevelt and Churchill met in Casablanca in January 1943, the momentum had shifted. The Red Army was on the offensive and moving west. Roosevelt's strategy of resisting Soviet territorial demands by substituting massive aid and an early Second Front had foundered. The Americans and the British would henceforth be on the defensive in trying to deny Stalin's gains. To make matters worse, Roosevelt and Churchill decided to land in Sicily, again postponing the Second Front and relegating their nations to further irrelevance in determining the outcome of the war. The Red Army continued its advance, but at an enormous cost. In November 1943, Stalin commemorated the anniversary of the Russian Revolution with a speech celebrating the survival and future resurgence of the Soviet state. He decried the Nazis' murder and pillage and promised revenge against the German invaders. "In the districts they seized, the Germans have exterminated hundreds of thousands of our citizens. Like the medieval barbarians of Attila's hordes, the German fiends trample the fields, burn down villages and towns, and demolish industrial enterprises and cultural institutions. Our people will not forgive the German fiends for these crimes." The U.S. President and the Soviet Premier met for the first time in Tehran in November 1943. Roosevelt had told Churchill in March 1942, "I can personally handle Stalin better than either your Foreign Office or my State Department. Stalin hates the guts of all your top people. He thinks he likes me better, and I hope he will continue to do so." After trying unsuccessfully to exclude Churchill from the meeting, Roosevelt accepted Stalin's offer to stay in the Soviet embassy. Roosevelt had indicated informally beforehand that he was open to establishing the Curzon Line as Poland's eastern border. Despite these gestures, he found Stalin cold and aloof during the first 3 days of meetings, and feared he would not succeed in developing the rapport he hoped for. He decided to try to reach Stalin on a more human level, employing the kind of charm and humor that would allow him to create a personal bond, the trademark of Rooseveltian diplomacy. He explained to Labor Secretary Francis Perkins, "I thought it over all night and made up my mind I had to do something desperate. I had a feeling that the Russians did not feel right about seeing Winston and me conferring together in a language which we understood and they didn't. On my way to the conference room that morning, we caught up with Winston, and I had just a moment to say to him, 'Winston, I hope you won't be sore at me for what I'm going to do.' Winston just shifted his cigar and grunted. I began almost as soon as we got into the conference room. I talked privately with Stalin. I didn't say anything that I hadn't said before, but it appeared quite chummy and confidential. Enough so that the other Russians joined us to listen. Still no smile. Then I said, lifting my hand up to cover a whisper, which of course had to be interpreted, 'Winston is cranky this morning. He got up on the wrong side of the bed.' A vague smile passed over Stalin's eyes, and I decided I was on the right track. As soon as I sat down at the conference table, I began to tease Churchill about his Britishness, about John Bull, about his cigars, about his habits. It began to register with Stalin. Winston got red and scowled, and the more he did so, the more Stalin smiled. Finally, Stalin broke out into a deep, hearty guffaw, and for the first time in 3 days, I saw light. I kept it up until Stalin was laughing with me, and it was then that I called him Uncle Joe. He would have thought me fresh the day before, but that day he laughed and came over and shook my hand. From that time on, our relations were personal, and Stalin himself indulged in an occasional witticism. The ice was broken, and we talked like men and brothers. Roosevelt made important headway at Tehran. The United States and Great Britain promised to open the long-delayed Second Front the following spring. Stalin agreed to enter the war against Japan once Germany had been crushed. Roosevelt acceded to the Soviet-desired territorial changes in Eastern Europe, requesting that Stalin implement them judiciously and not offend world opinion. He also proposed that the Soviets hold plebiscites in the Baltic states, but Stalin rejected that request. Roosevelt indicated that he would allow the Soviets considerable latitude in shaping those countries' future. He came away from the conference encouraged that the trust he had established with Stalin would moderate the Soviet leader's demands and convince him to hold free elections in Eastern Europe that would produce governments friendly to the USSR. The Red Army advanced into Poland in January 1944. That month, Stimson discussed Poland's future with Secretary Hull, who thought it essential to establish the principle of no acquisition by force. Stimson recounted, "I thought we had to consider other things more realistic than that, such as the feelings which would actuate Russia, A, that she had saved us from losing the war, B, that she, prior to 1914, had owned the whole of Poland, including Warsaw, and running as far as Germany, and that she was not asking for restitution of that." The Soviet Union quickly set up a friendly government in Lublin, Poland, that excluded representatives of the exile government in London. Later that year, the Red Army moved into Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. When the United States and Great Britain complained that they were only allowed a token role in the occupation, Stalin replied that the Soviet Union had been given only a token role in the occupation of Italy. Finally, on June 6, 1944, the long-awaited Second Front was opened, 1.5 years later than promised. Over 100,000 Allied troops and 30,000 vehicles landed on the beach at Normandy, France. 9,000 died during the landing. By that point, the Soviets, despite having suffered catastrophic casualties, were occupying much of Central Europe. Now the Allied forces would approach Germany from both the east and the west. Victory would soon be at hand. Up to that point, the Soviet Union had almost single-handedly battled the German military. Until the invasion of Normandy, the The Red Army was regularly engaging more than 200 enemy divisions, while the Americans and British together rarely confronted more than 10. Churchill admitted that it was the Russian army that tore the guts out of the German military machine. Germany lost over 6 million men on the Eastern Front, and approximately 1 million on the Western Front and in the Mediterranean. As the fighting intensified on the battlefield, the pace of planning picked up in the boardrooms. The United States invited friendly governments to Bretton Woods in New Hampshire to design the post-war capitalist economic order. Conferees approved U.S. plans to establish two major economic institutions, the development-minded World Bank, with initial funding of $7.6 billion, and the finance-minded International Monetary Fund, with $7.3 billion. The United States, which controlled two-thirds of the world's gold, insisted that the Bretton Woods system rest on both gold and the U.S. dollar, ensuring that U.S. economic hegemony would continue for the foreseeable future, and the United States would be banker to the world. Soviet representatives attended the conference, but later declined to ratify the final agreements, charging that the institutions they had created were branches of Wall Street. A Soviet official commented that, at first sight, the Bretton Woods institutions looked like a tasty mushroom, but on examination, they turned out to be a poisonous toadstool. The British understood that the new order would further erode their special sphere. Although Churchill had fulminated in late 1942, "I have not become the King's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire," the balance of power had irrevocably shifted. Some people have questioned the sincerity of Roosevelt's anti-colonial efforts during the war, and although he was certainly never the passionate crusader against colonialism that Vice President Wallace was, he did repeatedly express outrage at the colonizers' unjust and inhumane treatment of subject populations. Eliot Roosevelt reported his father's stern words to an apoplectic Churchill in 1941. "I can't believe," he said, "that we can fight a war against fascist slavery and at the same time not work to free people all over the world from a backward colonial policy." He pressed Churchill to end Britain's rule in India and beyond. During a press conference in February 1944, Roosevelt publicly excoriated British colonial rule in Gambia in West Africa, which he had visited the previous year. "It's the most horrible thing I have ever seen in my life," he declared. "The natives are 5,000 years back of us. The British have been there for 200 years. For every dollar that the British have put into Gambia, they have taken out 10. It's just plain exploitation of those people." Roosevelt spoke repeatedly about a post-war trusteeship system that would prepare the colonies for independence. One of the initial beneficiaries would be Indochina, which he insisted not be given back to the French after the war, as Churchill and Charles de Gaulle demanded it be. "Indochina should not go back to France," he told Secretary of State Cordell Hull in October 1944. "France has had the country, 30 million inhabitants, for nearly 100 years, and the people are worse off than they were at the beginning. The people of Indochina are entitled to something better than that." Churchill feared that Roosevelt would use Indochina as a wedge to force full-scale decolonization. Churchill made it clear that he would not contemplate such a possibility. He told Eden in late 1944, "There must be no question of our being hustled or seduced into declarations affecting British sovereignty in any of the dominions or colonies. Hands off the British Empire is our maxim, and it must not be weakened or smirched to please sob-stuff merchants at home or foreigners of any hue." Despite having Stalin's support for his decolonialization efforts, Roosevelt backed off from aggressively pressing the point, out of fear of rupturing the wartime alliance with Great Britain. With even less justification and more tragic consequences in the long run, he even backed off from decisively pressing the point on Indochina. However, in what turned out to be his last press conference on April 5th in Warm Springs, Georgia, exactly 1 week before his death, Roosevelt, accompanied by Philippine President Sergio Osmeña, promised that once Japanese troops had been ousted from the Philippines, the United States would grant the Filipinos immediate independence. Churchill did withstand U.S. pressure to grant India its independence after the war, but even that victory would prove ephemeral, as the Indian people took matters into their own hands. Although the world of formal empires and closed trading spheres would not vanish overnight, the U.S. economic juggernaut would brook no rivals from among the war-shattered economies of Europe and Asia. And undergirding the newly strengthened dollar would be the enormous power of the U.S. military. Roosevelt allowed his military advisors to play a central role in policymaking. In early 1942, he created the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In July, he appointed Admiral William Leahy to be his personal chief of staff and liaison to the Joint Chiefs. He also leaned heavily on Army Chief of Staff General George C. Marshall for advice. The War Department required an imposing new home that would come to symbolize its new role and the United States' vast military power. In the summer of 1941, the War Department's 24,000 civilian and military employees were operating out of 17 different buildings. Brigadier General Brian Burke Somerville informed Stimson that having everyone under the same roof would increase their efficiency by 25% to 40%. Construction on a new headquarters in Arlington, Virginia began on September 11, 1941. The builders kept the five-sided shape that had been chosen to fit the original site, even though the location had been switched. The first occupants began moving in April 1942, although construction wasn't completed until January of the following year. The man in charge of this massive construction project, Colonel Leslie Groves, would later make an even greater mark on the war effort. When finished, the largely windowless Pentagon was the biggest office building in the country, covering 29 acres and containing 17.5 miles of corridors. Visitors routinely got lost, and deliverymen were rumored to have wandered the halls for 3 days before being rescued. Halfway around the globe, Churchill and Stalin met in Moscow in October 1944. The meeting was codenamed Tolstoy. Churchill hoped to resolve the impasse over Poland. U.S. Ambassador to the Soviet Union, Averell Harriman, tagged along as an observer, but was not present when the two leaders conducted the most important business. Sitting in front of a fireplace in the Kremlin, Churchill cracked some of his favorite Polish jokes. The two leaders then set about defining British and Soviet spheres of influence in the Balkans and laying the groundwork for Western recognition of Soviet interests in Poland. On the back of a scrap of paper, Churchill proposed the share of influence each nation would exert. The Soviet Union would get 90% in Romania and 75% in Hungary and Bulgaria. Great Britain would get 90% in Greece. Yugoslavia would be split 50-50. Stalin took the paper, paused, and made a large check with a blue pencil before handing it back to Churchill, who commented, "Might it not be thought rather cynical if it seemed we had disposed of these issues, so fateful to millions of people, in such an offhand manner? Let us burn the paper." But Stalin urged Churchill to hold on to the historic scrap of paper, which Churchill called a naughty document. It was exactly the kind of deal that Roosevelt had set out to prevent. Hull protested the establishment of spheres of interest. Churchill decried U.S. hypocrisy. Is having a navy twice as strong as any other power, power politics? Is having all the gold in the world buried in a cavern, power politics? If not, what is power politics? Stalin quickly delivered on his part of the bargain. He stood aside in December 1944 as British troops brutally repressed a left-wing uprising in Greece, where the communists, who had led the underground resistance to the Nazis, were battling for power with reactionary forces who wanted to restore the monarchy. Great Britain supported the monarchists. Stalin refused to support the leftists, despite the fact that they had the backing of much of the Greek population. The U.S. public was shocked by Great Britain's behavior. Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill met for a second time at Yalta on the Black Sea in early February 1945. Though the Battle of the Bulge was still raging in Belgium, and fighting had intensified in the Pacific, the war had clearly turned in the Allies' favor. The time had come to finalize post-war plans. The Soviet Union was in a commanding position. The Red Army occupied Poland, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia, and was approaching Berlin. Deep rifts had appeared among the Allies, reflecting fundamentally different geopolitical and strategic views. The Soviet Union was preoccupied with security. Great Britain sought to preserve its empire. The United States wanted Soviet assistance in ending the Pacific War, fashioning a world economy that would be open to U.S. trade and investment, and establishing a United Nations to preserve the peace. The USSR had paid an enormous price in repulsing the German invasion. Many millions of its soldiers and citizens lay dead, and much of the nation was in ruins. The United States and Great Britain had helped the Soviets defeat Germany, but their efforts and resulting losses paled beside those of their Soviet ally. The United States had, in fact, come out of the war economically and militarily stronger than ever. But its diplomatic leverage was compromised by its failure to deliver the relief and assistance it had promised Stalin during the darkest hours of the war. The United States still had one major card to play. The promise of post-war economic assistance to help the Soviets rebuild their shattered nation. The once powerful British were in the weakest position, no longer able to press their claims independently. Great Britain now depended on U.S. goodwill and largesse to retain its status as a major power in the post-war world. The conflicts that surfaced at Yalta would eventually tear the alliance apart. But those tensions would not be apparent in the public display of unity or in the exuberant response by citizens around the world, desperate for good news after many long years of war. These differences played out in the debate over Poland, which was the focus of 7 of Yalta's 8 plenary sessions. Stalin declared, "The question of Poland is not only a question of honor, but also a question of security. Throughout history, Poland has been the corridor through which the enemy has passed into Russia. It was a matter of life and death for the Soviet Union." Stalin demanded recognition of the communist-led government operating out of the eastern city of Lublin that was provisionally ruling Poland. Its crackdown on internal opposition had sparked the beginning of a civil war. Roosevelt and Churchill backed the London-based government in exile, most of whose members were virulent anti-communists. Stalin accused them of being terrorists. It was to weaken the London Poles that Stalin committed the dual atrocities of killing thousands of Polish army officers in the Katyn Forest in 1940, and having the Red Army stop on the banks of the Vistula in 1944 while the Germans put down the Warsaw Rising. The three leaders compromised on setting up a Polish provisional government of national unity. The agreement stated, "The provisional government which is now functioning in Poland should therefore be reorganized on a broader democratic basis, with the inclusion of democratic leaders from Poland itself and from Poles abroad. Then the British, U.S., and Soviet ambassadors were to consult with the Polish leaders, and free elections open to all democratic and anti-Nazi parties were to be held." The three leaders agreed on the Curzon Line as the eastern border, despite the objections of the London Poles, but disagreed on Poland's western boundary, which was left for future resolution. The agreements were admittedly vague. Admiral Leahy, a veteran of the Spanish-American and First World Wars, who had spent time in the Philippines, China, Panama, and Nicaragua before returning from retirement to serve as Roosevelt's chief of staff, warned Roosevelt, "This is so elastic that the Russians can stretch it all the way from Yalta to Washington without technically breaking it." Roosevelt agreed, "I know, Bill, I know it, but it's the best I can do for Poland at this time." At Tehran, Roosevelt had written Stalin a personal note, promising that the United States will never lend its support in any way to any provisional government in Poland that would be inimical to your interests. Yet the London Poles, being hardline anti-communists, were clearly inimical to Stalin's perception of Soviet interests. Roosevelt understood that he had little leverage at Yalta. He was more excited about getting Stalin to agree to the Declaration on Liberated Europe, which promised to establish broadly representative governments through free elections. Though they didn't see eye to eye on Germany, the Big Three agreed to divide the soon-to-be-conquered nation into four military zones, with one to be controlled by France. Unable to reach an accord on post-war German reparations, they decided to establish a reparations commission, which could base discussions on a figure of $20 billion, with half going to the Soviet Union. Stalin agreed to come into the war against Japan 3 months after the end of the war in Europe. In return, the United States promised territorial and economic concessions in East Asia that largely restored what Russia had lost to Japan in the 1904-05 Russo-Japanese War. The news of Yalta ignited a kind of optimism that hadn't been seen for decades. Former President Herbert Hoover called the conference a great hope to the world. CBS war correspondent William Shirer, who later authored the renowned bestseller The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, declared it a landmark in human history. Roosevelt addressed the Congress upon his return, concluding, "The conference in the Crimea was a turning point, I hope, in our history, and therefore in the history of the world. We shall have to take the responsibility."